Welcome to episode 82 of the Jay Bunny's Music Hub podcast. I'm your host, Jay Bunny. Well, for this episode, I'm joined by Dave Kincaid, drummer for the band The Monarch, also the sort of mastermind behind The Monarch. Dave also previously played with Malevolent Creation, Borknagar, and Soulfly. As I mentioned in my interview here with Dave, I wasn't really familiar with him and didn't know about his band, The Monarch, until it was announced that Mark Rizzo, formerly of Soulfly and also of a ton of other bands, and Chris Clancy, the singer for Mutiny Within, had joined The Monarch. And because I support everything those guys do, I wanted to check it out. Got to talking to Dave online. He wanted to do a podcast to introduce this album and the band to the world and anybody that would be interested. This is a pretty long one, so I'm gonna stop here and get right into it. Without further ado, here's Dave. All right, what's up, everybody? It is Jay Bunny. I am here once again at home, once again on Skype. Joining me today is Dave Kincaid from, I learned quite a few bands, but currently of the band The Monarch. How's it going today, Dave?
Going great. How are you?
I'm doing well. Normally, if I would be sitting here at home on Skype, I'd be drinking a beer, but I got to work later, so it's kind of frowned upon to drink before work, so... Yeah. Had myself a Red Bull.
I have to work in a few hours too. This working nights business is something else, isn't it?
Yeah. It's, you know, it's funny. It's something that I've always done, and it's just, you know, and my kids are older now. We used to do it that, like, my wife and I were on opposite schedules because we had kids and somebody always needed to be available to them. But they're teenagers now, and my wife said to me, like, you don't really have to work nights anymore. I was like, yeah, but I get paid extra to do so. So I'm going to keep doing it at least until I get a job that'll pay me, you know, this or better during the day.
Yeah, I work on the railroad, so the pay doesn't really matter. It's not like it's different working at night or anything. It's just, I find the night to be a little bit more peaceful. You know, I can let my mind wander a lot more because there's just less stuff going on. You know, there's less trains and stuff to worry about because I'm like the engineer. I run trains. So, yeah, it's just I prefer the night over the day.
Yeah, it's definitely what the only thing that's annoying to me about that is it ever since, like, at night now versus at night like 5 years ago, like before COVID, there was stuff you could still do and places you could still go at night, like after work or whatever. And now, like, the only things that are open are like Quick Check and some McDonald's and White Castles. Whereas, like, yeah, in Jersey, it was always the thing of, like, oh, go to a diner. Like, there are no diners in Jersey that stay open late anymore.
Yeah, dude. And you know what? Even if they're still around, COVID killed so many good restaurants and so many great small businesses. I mean, I live in Chicago, and I'm kind of a food connoisseur. You know, I have a thing for Thai food, especially. I love spicy Asian food. And there was this phenomenal, the best Thai food I've had outside of Thailand was here in Chicago, and this little place, I've been going to it since 99, and they've exchanged owners, you know, hands and ownership two or three times, but it's always remained like in the same family, same recipes, and COVID just shut them down. And it's like, I had to learn how to make my own Thai food because this place went under. Horrible what happened to this world and in this country.
Yeah. What's funny is that, not funny, but like even down the road from where I work currently, there's a Walmart that used to be 24 hours. And long before I worked in the area, like, sometimes when my wife and I were dating, you know, it's like, what do you want to do tonight? Ah, fuck it. Let's just go walk around Walmart for a while. It's there. There's nothing to do. And now, like, they don't even stay open. And I asked one of the people in there one time, I was like, when are you guys going back to 24 hours? They're like, oh, corporate decided we're not. None of the stores. I was like, oh, all right then.
Where are you at in Jersey?
So I am in Sussex County in Vernon, where the notorious Action Park used to be, that's now called Mountain Creek.
Oh, okay. So like North Jersey?
Yep. Yep, okay. Right on the border of right in the border of New York.
Gotcha. Yeah, like, I was born in South Jersey.
Okay. Yeah, if you go like 10 minutes down the road from my house, you end up in Pine Island, New York.
Ah, okay. So we're kind of in the Rizzo land.
Yeah. I'd say that as I was telling you before we started recording, you know, I do booking for his cover band Acoustic Vendetta, and of the three of those guys, he's definitely the one that lives closest to me.
Yeah, that's also kind of up near where the 1916 Great White Shark attacks happened.
Huh.
Did you ever?
I was not aware of that.
Yeah, I'm a big history weird history kind of buff. And if you're familiar, I mean, everybody's familiar with Jaws, but they talk about the Jersey Beach. I think they called it the Jersey Beach attacks from 1916, where three or four people were killed in like that whole North Jersey area by a rogue great white that made its way into like a river system.
Huh.
So, and I got bored one day. I started Googling it and looking at maps, and it's like right in that area, like Elizabeth and I can't think of the other towns, but right in that sort of area where Rizzo lives.
Okay. All right. Well, getting into the reason that we're here today, I'll admit I'm a bit embarrassed that I was not familiar specifically with you until I saw the announcement that Mark Rizzo and Chris Clancy had joined your band, The Monarch. But looking you up online and Wikipedia and whatnot, you've been in a bunch of bands that I'm familiar with. Can you tell me a bit about like your journey in music and in those bands up until, let's say, 2012, when it looks like you stopped playing for a while?
Yeah, I'm like a hired gun drummer, or at least I was a hired gun drummer. You know, I was born in Jersey, but I moved out here when I was 8 years old, and I started getting into metal on my own pretty young. I always was kind of a classical music buff. So classical music is very progressive based, and it's just stuff that would catch my ear, you know, and metal caught my ear quite young. I remember the Ozzy Osbourne Randy Rhoads tribute album was like the first official listen for me when it came to metal. And I started playing drums really young, but there was nobody to play with out here. Whenever I wanted to play with somebody, I just, you know, start a band or whatever, you know, try to find that unique sort of love. And, you know, when you're a kid, everything is so much bigger and things emotionally hit you so much harder. So the music, you know, Metallica and Slayer and all that, it resonated with me. And I could not find, for the love of God, anybody else that loved this stuff. Everybody in Chicago was like a Smashing Pumpkins fan. So I would just play drums, you know, to my stereo in my garage for years, all the way through like junior high, high school, all that. And I would try to start bands with people, but it would always kind of, you know, they'd go down this road of like, oh, let's play alternative. You know, it's like, nah, dude, I want to play double bass and scream. So long story short, there's a band from Rhode Island called Vital Remains, a death metal band that was looking for a drummer in like the very early 2000s. And I started going to their shows, and they would play a lot of like 21 and older shows back then. So I would go to the shows and sneak in if I could. If I couldn't, like they played in Milwaukee, Wisconsin one time, and I had not turned 21 yet, and the place wouldn't let us in. So they let us stand outside the door out in the street and listen to the show. And I started auditioning for bands like that, you know, extreme death metal bands, but it was like progressively extreme. That's like the thing that hooked me, you know. But when I was that age, it was all about speed and playing really tight and really fast and technical. And they wanted somebody who wasn't like 17 or 18. And right. They wanted someone who had toured before, you know. This was like their fourth or fifth album that they had just released by the time I was auditioning. It was the Dechristianized album. So that was kind of a good connection. You know, it was Letdown. I didn't get to like tour with them or anything, but it was a good connection because when you talk to people that are older than you and you learn, you know, I've always learned through people about bands and techniques and just all this stuff, you know, like that's how you create your mental library. So as I created relationships, you know, with these guys, I would, and you need to go and listen to this band, and you need to go and listen to Morbid Angel, and you need to listen to Vader, and all, just all these different bands. And this was still during the prime time for these bands when they were younger, they were touring. I remember seeing the tour, the Emperor tour in 2000. Was it 99? It might have been 99. It was Emperor headlining with Borknagar and Divine Empire. And I believe there might have been someone else on that bill. But I ended up playing later on for two of those bands, Divine Empire and Borknagar. And I would go to these shows as, you know, younger, even still before 20. And I would talk to the bands and I would get to know like their drummers, and I'd be like, hey, you know, you're incredible, and how do you do this? And they'd be like, oh, just come and stand behind my drums and watch the whole set. And this became the thing for many years, you know. So this is pre-YouTube, when we actually had to listen to music to figure out what was going on. You know, you had to put the CD or the tape in and you'd listen to it. It was usually like not the best production when it came to extreme metal. And you would sit there and like, what is this guy playing? So getting to know these guys, I could stand behind them whenever they'd come through town, you know, hey, what's up? It's that kid. Yeah, come on, watch us play soundcheck, watch us play the show. And I got to learn a lot of what not to do from watching all my heroes, I guess I could call them, you know, Pete Sandoval and Trim and Gene Hoagland and Dave Lombardo. This is Dave Lombardo after he quit Slayer the first time, before he joined Slayer again the second time. You know, just getting to meet everybody. And eventually, I kind of put all of those what not to do's into my own technique and tried to create sort of like a sound of my own, you know, if that makes any kind of sense for extreme drummer world. But the other thing is too, you know, kind of to look back at the whole not being able to start your own band in Chicago thing. I always had this fascination with like bands like Metallica and Slayer, who have run now for what, 40 plus years. There's always been like a camaraderie sort of brotherhood in these bands that they started when they were young and they conquered the world and they released 15 albums and, you know, millions of shows and all this stuff, but they all did it together. You know, granted, a bass player here and there would leave, or the drummer would quit for 10 years and come back. But I always had sort of a, I guess, a jealousy of just bands like Metallica and Slayer and all them who stuck together through thick and thin. And it was pretty apparent to me early on that the only way I would ever be able to have a band of my own was if I started my own band. So when I was like, even before the Vital Remains stuff, you know, I was picking up an acoustic guitar and I learned how to kind of play, but I would hear melodies and stuff in my head. And I started writing the original like acoustic draft ideas for what would years, many years later become my songs. But keep putting that on the back burner, obviously, to play with the bands that I ended up playing with. So then fast forwarding a few years, maybe 2004, I was, you know, couch surfing and I was a broke young drummer who didn't have a job and just wanted to play heavy metal. I met a guy named Marco Martel here in Chicago, and we met through a mutual friend. He was playing with the guy who I was living with at the time. And Marco was just a really talented guitar player, a very nice, humble guy who was sort of quiet. And I just like gravitated towards him. He came down with me one day because I had my drums set up next to his band's drummer. And it was just Marco and I down there, and I'm playing drums. And Marco starts playing like Immortal, if you're familiar with the Norwegian black metal band Immortal. He starts playing an Immortal song. And I just started jumping in with him. And, you know, it kind of moved on to Morbid Angel and Slayer. And we're like, hey, what's up? So Marco and I, you know, weeks later, our relationship grew. We had dinners together and stuff. I'm like, hey, I have no money whatsoever, but I'm going to move to South Florida and join this death metal band called Divine Empire. Do you want to come? And I think I was probably 21. Marco was like 27 at the time. He's like, yeah, sure. That sounds like a great idea. Let me quit my job here in Chicago and we'll just move to Florida together. So that's what we did. And we ended up playing in this Divine Empire band for a while, which was actually partially Malevolent Creation. It was started by this guy, Jason Blackowitz, who was the original Malevolent Creation bass player. And both of those camps were very close. So Malevolent Creation has had like a football team's worth of band members over the years. And they had a tour planned with Bolt Thrower, Nightrage, and Necrophagist, a 7-week European tour. And they needed a drummer and they needed a bass player. And Marco and I were like, hey, we'll do it. So we learned like 16 or 17 songs in about a week and a half. And we went to Europe. And that was like our first official run back in, I think it was like 2005 or 2006. And it was just, you know, No money whatsoever. Living the dream. But hey, I mean, sold out shows through Europe every night as our first official, you know, tour. What could be better for a hungry young musician? You know, there was no YouTube back then. There was no, the internet existed, but it wasn't like this, you know, you and I talking to each other on Skype. So it was still very much, you know, hand to mouth. You know, tape trading was still a thing. CD trading was the thing back then. People came to shows and people bought your merchandise. And it was just like, I think about this on like a weekly basis. That was probably the best tour of my life. And I've done some real tours, but just thinking about the whole experience of that and not having money. And then we came home after 7 weeks in Europe and our electric had been off for, I guess, 6 of those weeks because Marco and I had a little condo together. Our power had been off. We didn't really have money to pay the power bill. And we opened up our refrigerator and it was like living because we left like tomatoes and meat and all kinds of stuff in there. So just a lot of good times, but not to get too stuck on that. So we did the Malevolent thing. I ended up leaving Florida shortly after that tour. Just I needed more in my life than death metal and, you know, drinking and drugs and stuff all the time. Then I got called by another drummer asking if I was interested in the Black Dahlia Murder gig, which I had never heard of that band. I mean, I had heard of them, but I wasn't a big fan of the vocals at the time. So it wasn't something that really, I guess, made much sense for me to learn. But I was like, hey, you know, this band is coming up, getting pretty big, pretty quick. Yeah, I'm interested in doing it. So they flew me to Detroit. They're like, okay, Kevin Talley's going to play drums until you can get all the songs down. So let's just learn what you can. We'll hash everything out at sound check and ready, set, go. How many songs do you know? And I'm like, one. So I ended up kind of wasting their time. I was with them for like 4 days before they decided, you know what, it's going to take a lot longer. He only knows 3 songs. How about we'll have Kevin Talley do the tour and we'll sort of figure out something after the tour's over, which was sort of a blessing because they ended up getting this really incredibly talented drummer, Shannon Lucas, phenomenal drummer. And so, and the funny thing is, they hadn't really split up. This was during the Miasma touring cycle, and they hadn't parted ways with like guitar players or whatever yet. They got rid of one of those guitar players eventually, and they brought in this guy, Ryan, who I ended up in 2007 playing in the band Arsis with. And I'm not sure if you're familiar with them. They haven't really done anything for a number of years now, but they were a phenomenal sort of like a progressive tech death metal band from, I believe they started as like one of those homework assignments at Berklee School of Music. Okay. So we ended up doing a tour and a bunch of festivals. We did a Morbid Angel tour in 2007. No, 2008, we did a Morbid Angel tour through Europe with them, Cataclysm, Keep a Kalesin, Marduk, and Arsis, and another phenomenal European tour. And in this time, I was in touch with a guy named Oystein, who formed the band Borknagar, like I mentioned earlier. And right. Oystein, Borknagar is a Norwegian, it's technically a Norwegian progressive metal band. They sort of fall into the black metal vein, because of a lot of, more or less because of when it started, you know, in the early 90s. And that's all that came out of Norway in the early 90s was this black metal shit. And I love black metal. I mean, the right kind of black metal. I wanted to have like this atmospheric thing, you know, and there's a particular few bands that I really, really love and the rest I just can't stand. And Borknagar was one of those bands that I just loved from the beginning. They needed a drummer because their longtime drummer, Asgeir, had decided to up and leave the band, which is ironic. I spoke to Asgeir today. I threw my name in the hat. I'm like, hey, my name's Dave. I'm an American. I'm younger than you, but I love your band. If you need a drummer, let me know. And Oystein reached back out to me. He's like, hey, send me a video. So I sent him an actual video cassette. I sent him a videotape to Norway, and he called me like 2 weeks later. He's like, I love it. Would you like to be in the band? I'm like, yeah, I'd love to be in the band. How are we going to work this? And at the time, I was in a relationship with a girl who lived in Amsterdam. So I was always jumping back and forth between Chicago and Amsterdam, and actually ended up living in Amsterdam for about 5 years off and on. But it was great because I just fly to Amsterdam and then I take the hour trip up to Norway, and we would make albums and go and play live shows and all this stuff. And it was a great time. So yeah, that's Borknagar. Did the Arsis thing, played, did one tour with them, then did a bunch of summer festivals, left that band. They got their old drummer back. Did Borknagar for a number of, I think maybe 4 years. We did two albums together, and we did Wacken, and we did a handful of shows. That was an interesting experience because I lived in the States still during the first album, flew over there, recorded the first album, and then whenever we would have any live dates, I would just fly to Norway. But then for the second album, I decided, you know, I'm sort of trying to still learn where I'm at in life and who I am. I'm going to move to Norway. That turned into a really not so wise decision on my behalf. I sold my truck here. I mean, I shipped my drums like via ship, you know, in a container. And it took 6 weeks. Yeah, it took 6 weeks for my drum kit to get there. And it was the real deal. I was 100% balls in. But Norway's just too damn expensive for a poor drummer from the States. And their immigration policies are way different than ours, because I tried everything I could. I was told that the Norwegian government subsidized black metal, and they subsidize. I know that they subsidized the arts, but we figured, hey, you know, we're a business and we're a band, a proper band in Norway. They will pay you to be here. And it didn't work like that. I was young and dumb. And so we recorded a second album. I ended up leaving the band. And just like a week after I left that band, I was put in touch with Soulfly's management, Max's wife, Gloria. And I'm like, hey, you know, I'm a huge Sepultura and Soulfly fan. And I would really, you know, I know that you need a drummer. I see that your son's playing drums for you. And they're like, and the ironic thing about Soulfly was the drummer that I replaced in Soulfly, Joe Nunez, was a close-ish friend of mine that I had known for years, maybe about 20 years, because he's from Arlington Heights, Illinois, and he used to work at Guitar Center in Chicago, in Arlington Heights. And I worked at the Guitar Center, that Guitar Center, around the same time as him. So when he would go on tour, I just started working there, and then I quit, and he came back from tour, and he went back to working at Guitar Center. So two Soulfly drummers worked at the same Guitar Center around the same times. And when he quit the band, you know, I called him and I'm like, hey, I just want to let you know that I'm thinking about doing this because it was offered to me. How do you feel? He's like, you know what? Best of luck to you. So I joined Soulfly. Well, before I joined Soulfly, they said, yes, come to Phoenix. So I flew to Phoenix, met with Max at his house, jammed with him, you know, for half a day. And we started putting together beats to, you know, he started showing me some of the riffs that he had for what ended up becoming the Enslaved album. And I started putting all this death metal shit, you know, double bass and blast beats and stuff to it. And he's like, all right, you want to do the album? Yes. Come out here in 2 weeks and you can track drums on the album and, you know, we'll see where it goes from there. But all of my drums, my pedals, my cymbals, everything were still in Norway. So I didn't know what was I going to do? But luckily I had 2 weeks. Gene Hoagland, who was in Fear Factory at the time, lended me one of his Pearl drum kits to track the drums on. Sabian lended me a bunch of cymbals and I was able to get pedals and stuff. So that's right around 2010, 2011-ish. We did the Enslaved album. I didn't hear anything from them for like 3 or 4 months. And I'm like, okay, you know, wintertime's coming. I'm just going to start figuring out what to do. And I was close with the producer, Zeus, that we made that Enslaved album with, you know, because it was sort of a weird, like, it was a weird production process making that Soulfly album. Max would sort of come in every day. And this was also, Tony Campos had joined the band as the bass player right at this time also. So Tony, I think, played like 2 or 3 shows with them. He played festivals with them right before I joined the band. So we all went in the studio. Max would come in sort of around like 10 or 11 in the morning. He would throw out all the riffs that he had. We would sort of structure everything together, and then he would go home. And then Rizzo and Campos and I would sit there and look at all the riffs and see what works, you know, make sure that everything was like feeling right tempo wise, and maybe restructure some stuff along the lines here and there, so nothing was repeating too much, but then, you know, everything, just make everything feel like it should. And what they weren't used to was a drummer that played and recorded to a click track. They were old school, you know, they just weren't used to drummers that played to clicks, you know, and they like to track stuff as a band in the studio, or at least that's how Max did with Sepultura, I was told. And that's how most of the Soulfly albums were made. So I kind of always had a process since Borknagar, especially because, you know, living apart from Øystein, who was the primary songwriter, he would send me these completed songs with a click track and no drums. And I would write the drum parts in my head and then show up in Norway and just track them along to that scratch guitar with the click track. And it was really like beautiful for guitar players because they don't have to stand there with you and play things 10,000 times until you get it right. So with Soulfly, I said, look, all I need is Rizzo to lay down the song to the click, you know, like just a scratch guitar part to the click, and then everybody can get out of here and Zeus and I can work on the drums and track everything. And, you know, by the time you show up in the morning, I'll have three more songs done. And that's how I did the drums for the Soulfly album. So it was very just, it was like very logistically streamlined. So that was Soulfly. And, you know, like I said a few minutes ago, I didn't hear anything for months after that. And I kept reaching out to Zeus, the producer, you know, hey, am I in the band? You know, he's like, dude, I don't know. You know, he was working on mixes for them and just they wouldn't send me anything. And then all of a sudden, one day I got a text from Gloria saying, OK, we're playing in Mexico. Or no. It wasn't even my first show was in L.A. at the Viper Room where River Phoenix died in the right. Viper Room. And then the very next show was their Dana tribute show, which was New Year's Eve of 2011. So then, hey, they didn't really give me much of a heads up, but it was awesome. Hey, you're going to be the guy. You're going to come on tour with us and be the drummer. Awesome. So I still didn't have any of the album. I had to work a little bit of magic to get it sent to me ahead of time to learn the songs, which was good because, you know, I'm a big fan of doing your homework, you know, and when you don't hear stuff between the studio and the stage for 4 or 5 months, you know, it's hard to remember what the hell you played in the studio. Who knows how they chopped it up or whatever. Then we just toured our asses off for that Enslaved album all over the world. And it was going great. And then I hurt my back. I kind of re-aggravated an old injury that I got when I lived in Amsterdam. I fell off my bike when I lived in Amsterdam and I slammed my tailbone into the ground really hard. And I felt my spine go brrrr. And that ended up creating what I deal with to this very day because I split my vertebrae and I didn't know. And wow. It healed really shittily. And I ended up having surgery years later. And they're like, hey, did you know you broke your back at one time? But the Soulfly thing, you know, I got worn down eventually just by a lot of things that were unfortunate because I look back at it and it's like, it didn't have to be that way, you know? But when you constantly deal with the same thing that's driving you crazy, there's only so much that you can take before you're like, it's time to move on. And at that time in my life, I think when you discover yourself and figure out who you are, that's when you really start to live. There's a lot of years that, and it's with everybody. Everybody takes a certain amount of time to really decide how valuable life is to them and who they are. And that was sort of a turning point for me. You know, I was done drinking and partying and doing all the stuff that I had done for years on other tours. And I had met someone that I wanted to spend the rest of my life with and have a family with. And, you know, I decided to hang it up and maybe it didn't go the way I wanted it to in the end. You know, it could have been a little bit less dramatic because we did have our moments back and forth But hey, man, I got to tour the world and play the biggest shows in the world and play some songs that I love to play, you know? So 2012, my very last show with them was in Bangkok, Thailand. I hung it up for a good 8 years. And then this COVID shit breaks out, and a former bandmate of mine in the Monarch, his name was Johnny, well, is Johnny, reached out to me. He's like, hey, you know, because we tracked a demo together. You know, I finished writing songs that I had started when I was a kid. And in 2010, we did like a 5-song demo together. And he was the guitar player, you know, he was the producer, the guitar player, all this stuff. I worked with a really great vocalist that was a friend of ours from Chicago. His name's Jarrett. He was the singer. He was like the voice that I had in mind when I would write the Monarch music. And we made this little demo. So 2020 rolls around and Johnny just out of the blue contacts me. He's like, hey, I've gotten really good at producing. And I decided one day to remix one of these songs, you know, check it out. And I listened to it and it just like, and mind you, I hadn't touched a drumstick, guitar, or none of that shit for 8 years. And I listened to it and immediately like the flame lit back up, you know, I'm like, wow, we should do this, but do it better. You know, we should re-record all this stuff, but really make it sound like a good album. He's like, well, I have all this stuff to do it. So immediately, you know, within that week, I started tracking down parts and gear because I still had drums. I just didn't have them set up in my basement. I started getting everything together and I would go to his house every day. And we started putting together what ended up becoming my first Monarch album. And it was awesome, man. It was just an awesome creative experience, you know, to come out of complete having done nothing for so long and step up to the plate, I guess, with like your own bat in the hand. You know, you're not playing somebody else's stuff. You're doing your own stuff. You're making your own creative decisions. And it's just like, there's nothing that feels better than that, you know? For being a musician, I think that that is like the ultimate, being able to create and say, hey, this is it. Now it's in your hands and it's finished. So we kind of had a stable lineup for a minute with that. It was all local guys who were good musicians, but you know, they had other jobs and other commitments and stuff. And one of them was an EMT fireman, paramedic, whatever. So he was always, always busy. Another guy lived kind of far away. The singer actually ended up moving to, the singer Jarrett ended up moving to Arkansas, which was hard when you want to have a band. I ended up having to fly him up here for a few days so we could film music videos. And you could tell that like he had kind of moved on in life, you know? So I started watching the band kind of, the guys who were in the band at that time sort of like fall away from the band. And things happen, people have heated arguments and it's just like one guy gets really controlling and it's like, hey, heads up, just letting you know, I understand that you're frustrated, but it's kind of my thing. It's my passion project. So I kind of have the end say here, you know, but yeah, everybody ended up leaving the band after a certain period of time, you know, one by one, which was fine. It was just supposed to be a project. I didn't really have any like set dates. Oh, we're going on tour with whoever, you know, it was just, hey, this is COVID. We're making music. Some people just handle things differently emotionally than others. But I did keep one guy around for a while who was the lead guitar player on the first album. And I would go to his house because he lived close. And it's kind of hard to explain my writing process. You know, I'm the kind of person who I hear rhythms in my head all the time because I'm a drummer. And I also hear progressions that can become riffs. And I'll hear chords and it's really frustrating when I'm running a train and this stuff happens because I can't use any electronic devices to record it. And that's sort of like my little thing. My phone is just full of voice memos of me humming riffs and I'll be driving or in the grocery store or whatever. And I'll hear like, you know, and I'll have to, oh man, I'll hear this progress into something and I have to hum it into my phone so I don't forget it. So I would go to this guy's house. He would sort of transcribe everything from my phone or my head to the recording software. And that's how we sort of put together the songs for this new album. And he was obviously a more skilled guitarist than me. I'm a horrible guitarist. So he would go and throw his own thing on it. Be like, hey, you know, I'm suggesting that we do this. And then he ended up eventually leaving the band. And I'm like, well, if I'm going to have all this material, I need to have guys that are dependable. So I reached out to Rizzo. Actually, Rizzo reached out to me. He's like, hey, I like your first album. Let's do something together. Like, well, just so happens that, you know, the lead guitarist left the band. Are you interested? He's like, yep, let's do it. When can I fly out? Like, hang on a second. I got to get everything else recorded. So that was perfect. Rizzo was the first one. Then conveniently, like very conveniently, Marco Martel, who years ago I was, you know, in Malevolent Creation with, he had just moved back to Chicago. And he was looking to do something. I'm like, dude, I need a rhythm guitar player, you know, somebody to basically do everything for my music, because I'm going into the studio to track drums. And I have all these songs that I put together. You know, after that previous lead guitar player left the band, I had to do it on my own as far as pre-production was concerned. And it was actually a blessing that he left, because I learned how to use software, you know, like I use Sonar and Studio One. And he basically forced me into playing guitar on my own and writing on my own and learning MIDI and how plugins and all this tech shit works and interfaces and stuff. I mean, it was really an awakening, but I just kept on kind of pushing through with crafting the blueprints for the album. And Marco came into the band and Marco's like, let me hear some of it. You know, so I sent him the demos. He's like, yep, I think I can really add something cool to this. Let's do it. And, you know, just like the previous guitar players, I want everybody to feel like they are a part of this. You know, if there is some sort of like creative, suggestive, whatever that you're hearing that needs to be there, you think this could be better, or this part's too long, or change this riff or whatever, you know, by all means, please. I'm just a fucking drummer. So Marco went and put his own taste on all of this stuff. And we're like, okay, well, we need a bass player. Rizzo to the rescue again. He's like, I think we should ask Campos to do it. So Campos is obviously in a million bands, and he's in like some big bands. He's in Fear Factory, Static X. He's got all this stuff going on. There's no way Campos is going to do this. But Rizzo and Campos and another guy did like a cover tour, cover song tour. I think it was 2021. And we all got together and hung out. You know, I'm like, hey, to Campos, I'm doing this project. Would you be interested in playing bass? He's like, yeah, no problem. I'll do it. So now we had everybody except a singer. Singer number one couldn't do it. He lives in Arkansas now. And it's just, I couldn't find, he's the kind of guy that you need to be in the room with, you know, to sort of coach as far as how you want the songs and the parts to be produced vocally. So it wasn't going to work with him. I had to find somebody else. And I had a tip on another guy who ended up, yep, I can do it, no problem. Very talented local guy. Turns out he decided to run away with the circus. Like, I can't get a break with singers here. Another guy, super confident, comes up. Totally not the sound for it. I mean, and this guy started recording vocals and everything. We were in the studio for like a week, and it's just like, you could tell that he was really having a hard time with the parts and the arrangements that I had come up with for the vocals, you know, and it sucks, but sometimes just no matter how good a singer is, he's not the guy. And luckily enough, the producer who I had tracked everything with here in Chicago, you know, he's basically the extra member of the band, you know, he sits me down and he's like, okay, let's start at square one. Who is the one singer that you've always heard in your head that would fit your material the best? And I'm like, Chris Clancy. And Chris, I had actually been in touch with many years ago about doing the Monarch before even the first demos. You know, it just, Chris is like, he's a virtuoso. He's a musician, number one, but there's singers, you know, there's people that can sing and they can sing in key and they sound okay. And there's guys that scream and they have a good guttural or whatever, but they can't sing. Chris is like the whole thing and more. You know, he's everything from the most brutal of death to the sickest thrash, but then he can do opera and he can do Freddie Mercury, and he's it, man. And I'm like, there's no way. You know, I looked him up because at the time when I first started talking to him years ago, he was living in North Jersey. Yeah. When he was playing in Mutiny Within.
Right.
And I looked him up and it said that he lived back in the UK again. I'm like, there's no way this guy's going to want to do this with me. Whatever. I'll send him a message, see what he says. He gets back to me 5 minutes later. He's like, yeah, I remember you. How you been? You know what? send me the stuff. I want to hear it because I kind of talked it up. You know, I'm doing this project with Rizzo and Campos and my buddy Marco and all that. Check it out at least. He listens to one song, which is Dark Heart Phenomena, the first single that we released back in October of last year. And he's like, dude, I'm in. And I started sending him all the vocals and my scratch vocals that I tracked at home for like melody ideas. And he nailed it. He nailed everything in like a week. That brings us to now. Here we are many months and tens of thousands of dollars and everything else later. And we're a week away now. Well, by the time everybody hears this, it should be release day.
Yeah. So were you, all the other relationships are pretty clear. Were you familiar with Chris due to the fact that like around the time that you were in Soulfly, I think that Mutiny Within was still signed to Roadrunner as well?
You know, I want to say I remember Chris from maybe 2007, 2008-ish. Yeah, that's probably the last time I spoke with him. Maybe 2009, but I don't think it went any time later. And honestly, I never really paid attention to anything else when I was in Soulfly, because it was just, that was it.
Yeah, see, so for me with Chris, because I happened around the time that their record came out on Roadrunner, I was doing Street Team for Roadrunner. And so like that was coming out. And there was a couple of other bands that came out around that time that I really liked, Taking Dawn and Hail the Villain. And like, unfortunately, all three of those bands that were like the baby bands on the label at the time all got dropped eventually after their first album came out. But I still follow, you know, those bands, if they're still around, or those band members' projects. And like you said about Chris, I really, it's just his fucking voice, man. And so every time that I see following him on social media that he's involved in some other thing, that catches my attention. And so when I saw, and again, not being familiar with you and not knowing, you know, your pedigree, as it were, I was like, wow, like, I don't know who this dude is. And I didn't know who Marco was. I don't know who these guys are, but yeah, Chris and Rizzo and Campos all in this band, like, I gotta pay attention to this.
Well, you know, thank you. I mean, at least somebody is, because I'll tell you what, this is a hard business. And I am thoroughly convinced that you can go and write the greatest album of all time. I'm not saying I wrote the greatest album of all time, but you can literally be a phenomenal, incredible, unique musician like Rizzo, or incredible, unique singer like Chris, and just always have bumps in the road. Like, it's not easy. This is a hard business and it sucks. And it's shitty because I've watched it go downhill for many years. You know, I've never been like a super famous guy or anything. I'm the kind of drummer that started by practicing, you know, 6 hours, 8 hours every single day until I had holes in my fingers, like really putting in the effort to play good. And I know that those guys are exactly the same. You know, Rizzo didn't become this Mark Rizzo guitar god just like out of luck. You know, he's probably practicing right at this very moment. You know, like all he does is practice. And it's just the truth, man. Practice makes perfect. And the thing is, it's 2024. There's so much oversaturation. There's so many bands. And I got to tell you, a lot of them are not very good, but somehow these bands are like good at creating hashtags or algorithms or some shit, because, you know, they're getting traction and they're TikToks and Instagrams and whatever. And they're blowing up. You know, there's so many bands that I like, I'll scroll, you know, I'm guilty of scrolling through all these social networks too. And something will pop up and I'm like, what is this shit? You know, I'm turning into an old man, and I'll listen to maybe 10 seconds of something. And it's like, oh, you know, and it all sounds the same to me. You know, it just,
yeah, you and I are the same age, and I feel the same way about a lot of things.
Dude, I just don't get it somehow. These bands and the money that they're making, you know, like, I'll give it, this band Sleep Token is very talented, and they write these depressing sort of, like, it almost makes me feel like I'm on Xanax, their songs. You know, it's like a depressing Devin Townsend, and Devin Townsend is depressing to me, but I love Devin. He's, you know, I wish, my friend Michelle actually said it best about Devin. I wish I could lick his brain, you know, because he's just, he is just, everything that Devin does is incredible. And not to get off topic here or anything, but like, you know, Sleep Token, they're making so much money, and they're just, I mean, they're playing Wembley, for Christ's sakes. You know, it's insane. And I did everything I can for this album, man. You know, there were a lot of hands in the creation of this album. You know, like I said, the old guitar player had pieces here and there that he contributed to it that I'm like, yep, these are great. They're staying. You know, everything, the way I look at anything is like, if it's made for the band, it's always for the greater good of the band. You know, it's not for egos. It's not for, oh, me, this or that. It's always for the better of the band. When you're in a band, maybe I'm wrong, but like, I look at it as like a brotherhood. You know, it should be just short of like a relationship mentally and emotionally and you know, just short, like you're not physical together. You know, it's not like a sexual kind of thing, but it's kind of in the same vein as that almost. Like when you lock in with a guitar player and you're playing just like in uniform together, you know, it's like there's no better feeling of just, yes, we're going to get to the spot and we're going to hit the one together. And oh man, we just killed it and everything sounded great. But it's sad, dude. We put so much into this album and it seems like nobody really gives a shit. You know, I went to this phenomenal producer here in Chicago, incredible drummer, incredible guitar player. We got such good production and we worked on guitar tones for weeks and flew Rizzo in and he nailed all these solos in a couple days. And then we're like, you know what? What else can we do? He's like, well, I can add even more stuff. You know, he's adding like little jingles in the back, like for atmospheric kind of rhythms and stuff. And he's adding all these special leads and just changing the songs for the better completely. I went to the producer who does all of Korn's stuff now, Chris Collier. You know, he's a hot shot, big time heavy metal producer. And I'm like, dude, I want your sound. Because if you listen to Chris Collier's sound, you can feel the music. And there's not a lot of producers that get you to feel what this guy was able to get. And spent a lot of money out of my own pocket on that. You know, I did all the artwork on my own as well. You know, Marco and I would go out. Marco's really into photography and video filmography and all that stuff. So we would go out and we'd catch like scenes and we'd wait for certain times of the day to go and film shots of just sunsets and weird shit that I could use in the artwork. And then I'd put it in the Photoshop and manipulate it and layer and texturize and stuff. I mean, this is a lot of work that everyone works so hard on. And then I send it to record labels and they're like, well, you know, maybe we're not the right label for you. Or, oh, you know what? We're not signing anybody right now. You know, come back in a year. Oh, you only have streams on your old album. I'm like, dude, I didn't even promote the first album. Yeah, but you need to have a minimum of like 500,000 streams. It's like, you won't even listen to this shit. Nope, we won't listen to it. It's a sad world, dude.
So that's like with this podcast, you know, this is something that I started on my own because I went to college for radio and I haven't gotten there yet. I had to drop out of school because I had a bad car accident, messed up my back that I had to have surgery on, that I need to have another surgery on. So I was like, all right, I got to take some time off of school to like recover from this injury. Then my girlfriend got pregnant with our first kid. It was like, all right, now I just got to get a job. Like, I don't have the luxury of like trying to figure out when I'm going to like going back to school. Like, we got a kid on the way.
Yeah.
And so I've just been working since, like, you know, my older son is 16 now. So I've been just like focusing on like keeping people fed since 2007. And like, every time that I'm looking for a new job, it's like, it would be cool to get into radio, to get into like that industry that I went to school for. And it was just never working out. And so when I was in between jobs, I was like, all right, I'm just going to spend $90 on like a handheld recorder off of Amazon and just start sending emails and see what happens. And, you know, I'd mentioned before having been on the street team at Roadrunner and that one of the baby bands that I liked at the time was Taking Dawn. And Chris, their singer, was still doing Taking Dawn, but with a new lineup and under a new name, but they were still playing those old songs in addition to new stuff. So I messaged Chris. I was like, hey, man, I'm thinking of starting this podcast. You want to be the first guest? He's like, yeah, dude, totally. So, you know, I went into the city on Easter Sunday because that was when the show happened to be, interviewed him before their show. And, you know, but like, because it's just this thing that I started on my own and no one really knows who I am and I don't have, you know, like Joe Rogan numbers or whatever the shit. Like, yeah. Sometimes I'll reach, like, look on social media, like, okay, send an email here. Oh, publicist, this, that, whatever, and trying to go down the right channels. And then I've had, like, PR people, publicists, like, oh, well, how many people are following you on Facebook and Twitter and Instagram? And when I first started, when I first started, I was like, I don't even have a Twitter or an Instagram. They're like, well, then you don't have an interview with our band. Check back when you have those things and have followings on them.
Yeah, it's disgusting. I was like,
oh, okay then.
And the thing is, you know, I'm not going to throw any names out here, but these people that control, you know, they're at the helm of this stuff, and you're basically, as a no-name band, you're at their mercy, and they charge a hell of a lot of money to do what they do, which I've recently found out is really nothing. But when it comes down to it, at like the end of the day, they have absolutely zero talent. It's really frustrating, you know, and Rizzo main guy, as far as like suggestions, and because he knows everybody, you know, he hooked me up with the publicist that we were using, Maria Ferrero. You know, she's infamous because she got Testament and Metallica and Lamb of God, and you know, there's some pretty big goddamn names. You know, she was the woman in charge of all their PR back in the day, and she's still, I believe, in charge of Lamb of God. You know, I went to her and I'm like, hey, I need a publicist. And if I'm going to do this, I don't care. I want the world to find out about this and for people to hear it. And if they don't like it, great. There's tons of bands that I hate, you know, I'll just be another band that people kind of like or don't like. It's no big deal, but I want it to be heard because so much goddamn effort has gone into this. And it's just like, I watch even her send stuff out, and the traction, you know, nobody cares. Nobody cares. So what do you do at this point? You know, Rizzo's been a help though, man. He suggested her. He hooked us up with the label that we're releasing the album through, which was a big relief on my end, because with the first album, I paid to print all the CDs and then I shipped them all out of my basement, like put them in mailers and put the addresses on the mailers and went to the post office, you know, and when you're starting to do like a couple hundred of them, that's a real pain in the ass. So I told them all I wanted, you know, if these labels are going to screw me around and be like, oh, well, it's really great. That's the thing. Everybody who listened to it, and I'm talking big names, big guys, big heavy hitters in the industry who are in charge of labels that everyone knows, and without name dropping any of them, one of these guys who really, really liked it kind of helped basically everything that all these metalheads listen to get off the ground. You know, a couple of the biggest bands in metal, we'll put it that way. And he loved it. He said, timeless. I absolutely love it. The production is fucking crushing, but I cannot sign you because of a really, really, really weak, lame excuse. And it had nothing to do with streams. It had nothing to do with, it was a horrible excuse. And I'm like, come on. So everything you would want is there. Kind of something really so small that nobody else would give a shit about. He's like, yep. So I don't know, man. It sucks.
I've heard from other bands, that they've run into issues with labels, like, well, you know, and I, or not even personal, some of our conversations I've had, other things I've read online. I don't even remember what band it was, but I remember one band I was reading about recently. It was like a female fronted band, and it was like, well, you know, the labels were telling me, well, we already have like one band with a girl, like we don't really need another one.
They treat it like it's a parking lot full of cars. You know, we already have two Chevy Tahoes. We have a red one and we have a black one. Why would we want a silver one? We already have two of them. Why would we want a third? That's going to cost more money. Like, right. Well, dude, I've seen what you've done with bands like Slipknot, and I've seen what you've done with bands like Lamb of God. And, you know, I'm just throwing bands out there.
Yeah.
These are bands that people didn't like in the beginning, but because you exposed them to ears to hear, these bands became mega corporations, you know? It's all about getting it into people's ears. And if you can't help somebody do that, what the hell's the point of even having a band? They're like, well, maybe you need to go and, you know, you need to buy on to a tour. That's how you're going to have people hear you. And then, you know, if you can sell some merch and buy on to a tour and, you know, get people into you that way, then, you know, maybe we'll be interested. It's It's like, so wait a minute. I'm 40 years old. I have three kids. I have a wife, a house, a mortgage. I have three vehicles. I have all these bills. And you want me to go and spend however many thousand, you know, call it $50,000 to $100,000 probably by now to buy onto a tour to play at probably some shitty time for 30 minutes when there's 50 people there, and then have to cart people like Tony Campos and Rizzo and these guys who, you know, are tour bus only guys, cart them around like what, in my truck? Come on, dude. I was born, but I wasn't born yesterday.
You know? Right, right. So getting back to the Monarch, so one thing that I noticed, because I was looking at the old stuff and then you sent me the new stuff, and even from that very first music video, you have the same like band logo on everything. It's on the cover of the new album. I was just wondering, like, obviously that's the band's logo, but is there any other sort of meaning to that other than this is what represents us as this band?
The symbol, well, it's not religious. And I've gotten that question a few times because, you know, it looks like a cross, but then it looks like an inverted cross. It's nothing to do with religion. And I believe, just my own taste, there should never be politics or religion in music, because it's just that kind of stuff pisses off too many people. It's more or less like, if you really want to get down to the ground floor with it, it kind of looks like an M in a way. It kind of has like a T in there. It looks like it says the Monarch, you know, symbolically, but it's also sort of like a key, you know, it's like the Monarch key. And I just thought, when I came up with this symbol, it was years ago that I was going through a website back in the dial-up internet days, looking at like runes and all kinds of stuff, because every band that's something has a symbol. You know, Metallica has the M, and they have the Lodestar, and Opeth has that O that sort of has this like majestic kind of creepy beauty to it. Emperor has their big majestic grandiose E, and it's like every band that's something has a symbol. Slipknot has their Slipknot S. So we needed some sort of symbol. And when I was looking at these runes, I believe there's like a headstone or something, if I can remember the story, a headstone in somewhere in like Sweden that had a partial version of what became my symbol on it. And I kind of took pieces of that and added a few extra lines. And I'm like, that's pretty interesting looking. You know, it's simplistic. It doesn't really have like a religious kind of thing to it. But then again, it's like, the Monarch is a leader, you know, it's a power above all. It is the person who reigns supreme, and it sort of does have this kind of crest to it in a way, you know, like I could almost see it on some, like at the top of a crown or something. So it was something that fit, and I figured it looked good.
Okay, fair enough. And then you were talking before about, you know, doing the photography for the album and whatnot. As I said before, I downloaded all of this stuff that you had sent me, and I noticed looking at like this high resolution, very large picture of the album art, you know, that it kind of looks like there's like trees on fire, and then like in the fire I can see faces, but they don't look like the faces of people that are in the band. Who are these faces?
That's cool that you see that. All right. So the album covers are physically crafted by an artist who lives in Africa that I met. His name's Mustafa, and he's a really good just digital artist. And I'm like, look, I like your coloration. I like some of the stuff that you come up with. I'm sort of starting to weave over to trying to visualize my music with some of the past stuff that you've done. If I give you an idea, can you craft my idea, like a blueprint for it, and then I'll finish it? He's like, absolutely. So I gave him sort of my synopsis for, you know, the scene and on the very first album cover, and he came up with this thing. And then I had a bunch of changes, you know, add trees here, make this look like this. And if you notice, all the album covers have a centipede hidden somewhere in them, and that's because centipedes are like my big fear, but we can come back to that. But he would go and create all this stuff, and then I would go and mess with it for months, and I'll change stuff around and where the symbol's placed and the logo and the color. The color's a big thing with me. I mess with the color until I'm blue in the face. So same thing with this album. During the creation of this whole process for this album, I've had this picture in my mind of looking up at the sky through trees, and that perspective that you get of the trees towering straight up. And the whole gist of this album, like the first album was sort of an experiment. You know, it was about all the evils of the world. This album is more of, I want to say it's like my interpretation sonically of the trip through life to death. And in February of 2022, a really, really close friend of mine, Todd, passed away from COVID. And it was totally unexpected. Todd was a locomotive engineer at Amtrak. He was one of the kindest, funniest sons of bitches I've ever met in my life. And I watched this guy. I mean, I wasn't there when he passed away, but I watched this guy just fall from this towering figure of might, and COVID killed him. And it was like one of the first close friends that I've ever lost in my life. I've lost family members, but I had never lost such a close friend, you know?
Yeah.
And that broke me, man. It ripped me apart. And Todd was a super positive supporter of all this Monarch stuff. He's like, dude, I love this sound. I love reading the lyrics, and I get so emotionally involved as a listener, and then bam, it comes around and punches me right in the throat. Like, I love it. So during the process of crafting the pre-production for this album, I was sending stuff to Todd. I'm like, man, you thought the first album was epic? Wait until you hear this shit. He's like, fuck yeah. So I thought going down this road for directional, you know, especially lyrically for this album, I thought the best way to sort of honor Todd was to not only dedicate it to him, but to, you know, hide him in there on the cover, because he is a big part of this. You know, he's a part of the reasoning behind the sound. Fast forward to September of 2022, I lost my dad totally unexpectedly. And that's the first parent I've lost. And when you lose a parent, man, it hits you. Life really, really hits you hard. And it started becoming apparent to me that this out, because I was in the middle of drum tracking when my dad died, and I put it on hold for a week to go out to New Jersey and, you know, deal with my dad's services and stuff in his house and all this. And then I came back, and the first thing I did was I'm going in the studio and I'm going to finish tracking drums. That was sort of the starting gun, you know, that this album had to be geared around. If this was the last piece of music I would ever do in my life, it has to really mean something. It has to be an experience of what death and loss and grief and everything means to me. So I decided to put my grandparents' faces in there as well, because losing them hit me like a ton of bricks, especially my grandfather lived to 95. He had a hell of a good run. But my grandmother passed away in 2008, and she had a battle with cancer. And it sucked, because she was like the healthiest lady that I ever knew. Never smoked, never drank, never did drugs, did yoga, swam, all this shit. And she had cancer kill her. And that really, during that time, you know, I was still kind of a drinker back then. That experience and that loss helped me sort of start questioning religion and my belief and stuff, you know, and it led me down a dark road for many years, is what I'm trying to get to. So I figured all of that stuff that happened previous before this album needed to be channeled into this album. And that's why I figured, you know, I had to hide faces of the people I've lost in the cover, because it was real personal, you know?
Yeah, no, that makes sense. All right, so you mentioned a bit earlier about having a thing with centipedes, and I did notice in at least one of the music videos that there is a centipede at the end. Can you elaborate on the whole centipede situation?
Yeah, there's actually centipedes hidden all over the place. In the two newer videos, there are centipedes at the end. And then in the very first video that we did for the first album, All the World's Pain, I kind of had sporadic centipedes thrown in there. And you know, it's strange. It's like, so you're familiar with the East Coast, obviously. You live in Jersey, and I'm sure you have seen centipedes everywhere out there. You know, they're pretty in those older, like Quaker town sort of old colonial houses. They're almost like a staple in the basements and the bathrooms, and you know, centipedes are everywhere on the East Coast. You don't really find them that much out here in Chicago. You have to look for them more. But when I was a kid growing up in Pennsylvania and, you know, across the river in Jersey, I never really paid attention to them. until I started to notice them and how disgusting they were. And it, just as time went on, centipedes became like my ultimate fear, you know, just everything. If you look at a centipede and just really study how creepy these things are, and you see how they move, you know, they're so sporadic and they're fast, and there's just something that it's like unhinged about how centipedes act. And they became my ultimate, you know, phobia, to the point where I made myself sick over them years ago, because I had a centipede encounter in a basement with just this massive beast of this thing was like demonic almost. And it attacked my hand, and it ever since then, dude, it's like I cannot even stomach centipedes. So, you know, that's like the ultimate fear, is being asleep and having one of these things like creep up on you or crawl on you, or, you know, you're in the dark and you felt something on your hand and you turn the light on and it's one of those. I mean, it's just, considering that I've dealt with every other possible disgusting, grotesque thing in life, you know, and in my job, I've seen people at their lowest, to where, you know, they've committed suicide. And, you know, that's obviously, with a train, that's never a pretty turnout. But centipedes have become the nemesis to me. So I decided to include them in everything. You know, they're just my ultimate fear. And why not embrace your fears, you know?
All right. Fair enough. And so you said they were in both videos, and they're hidden, you said, throughout, as far as like in the art of the albums as well.
Yeah, they're in all of the artwork, and they're where they should be. You know, you never see a centipede out in broad daylight in the middle of the room. So I figured artwork wise, I would kind of treat them the same and just hide them sporadically. But they're supposed to represent the torture, you know, the torture in life, and the unsettling, dirty sort of evil in life, you know. So whenever I have a centipede that just randomly pops up, or, you know, it's in the artwork, if you look for it, you'll find them. That represents the evil of man, and just the whole the world is a worse place than a better place, you know. And the centipede's more or less like the visualizer for that, if that makes any sort of sense whatsoever. It's more than a bug.
Fair enough. Now you got me zooming in on the album artwork again to see if I see it.
On the new album, I think on the first album there were two or three that we hid, and on the new one there's just one on the cover. But it's just something to look for. It's hidden in there.
I'll have to keep looking to find that out, to see if I can't find that. Yeah. I found the faces. Now I got to find the centipede. Now, is there a particular, as far as like the band's sound, lyrical themes, et cetera, is there a particular direction that you're exploring with this project?
Yeah, I think music needs to be expressive in a way that does not, I mean, it's 2024, everybody's offended by something, but I think music needs to be expressed in a way that it doesn't hurt anyone. You know, music is something that, at least for me, that I confide in. You know, I can enter a music experience in one mood and in a certain feeling and leave in a completely different emotional state. So no politics, no religion. But when it really comes down to when you look deeper, it's how I feel about life. It's how I feel about people. And it's how I feel about love and hate and all the different emotions that we can feel as human beings. And the way the world is now, to where everybody is so self-righteously obsessed with themselves and their image. And perfect example, if you look at social media and you look at these girls on like Facebook or whatever, and then you meet somebody in person, 9 times out of 10, girls look completely different, because they'll sit there for hours and take pictures of themselves until they have that right angle, and they look just completely different than they would in person, you know. And you're getting like this fake version of someone through this social outlet, you know, that this is what they want you to think that they are. But then when you meet them, it's like, okay, you know, just as an example. And that's the way everyone is now. I mean, you're not going to post a bad picture of yourself, you know. I mean, I do, because I don't care. But people are obsessed with themselves and how they look in the eyes of other people. And the fact of the matter is that there's so much more to life, you know. There's so much more than petty bullshit. And just look, like when you drive down the road, you know, how many people are on their phone? they're not paying any attention to what the real task at hand is. You know, what's important? Safety is important. Making sure that you don't cause an accident or drive off the side of the road and hurt someone else. No, all anybody cares about is themselves anymore. And I try to point that out lyrically, you know, how people will kill over how they get looked at by someone else, or they will kill someone for their shoes. And obviously, like, you know, war has been happening and people have been killing each other since the beginning of time. That's just like a part of man. But most of those wars over the past however many thousand years have been fought over religion, land, money, you know, things that really in the end don't matter. When you die, you can't take any of this stuff with you. You can't take an opinion with you. You can't take money with you. Life to me is more about making it, I guess, purposeful for later on. You know, like when you're growing up, you're learning what you should be. But realistically, not many people make it past 30 if they live this horrible lifestyle. I've known a lot of people who've gotten into drinking and drugs and motorcycles and all this stuff, and they don't make it like even to their 30s. The way I see it, when you're like a kid and you're learning what your purpose is in life, you should really be looking forward to like what is later on. And now that I'm 40, you know, I feel old, but this is way different than life is way different than what I expected it to be, you know, when I was a teenager in my 20s or whatever. Like part of me never even could foresee myself being 40. You know, so now I'm trying to change all these things about myself for the better, being 40, you know, taking vitamins and all this stuff. But trying to get back onto what I was trying to make a point of lyrically, I want to be able to point out all of mankind's issues with itself and how selfish we are and how there are children out there that don't have a chance in life because they might have medical problems or they might have parents that just don't care about them. You know, parents that were reckless and should have never had kids, and kids that just won't even get to experience like anything in life because they were dealt a bad hand. And then there are people out there who have everything in life. And they've been spoon-fed their entire life. You know, money's never been an issue. They've never had to work for anything. And they don't know anything about what the other side of the world really has to face on a daily basis. You know, like there are people out there right now who are starving to death. Meanwhile, there are people in this country, you know, right down the street from me, that are just stuffing their faces full of trans fats and all this stuff. And it's just like, man, we all die. You know, everyone will die one day, and it's all the same for everyone. That's what makes us so unique. We're on Earth, this weird species of such, like, we've had such incredible, in just the past 200 years, we've invented aviation, we've invented vehicles, we've invented nuclear science, all of this incredible stuff that mankind has brought to the world. But then we turn around and we use it usually as like a negative kind of thing. We destroy ourselves with things that were created to more or less be good when they were invented. And it's a sad world, man. It's a really, really sad world. And I guess lyrically, I want to be able to point that out. You know, this is what the world means to me. This is what humans have sort of done to each other in my eyes, and let it be heard. But I also try to write lyrics in a way that you can decipher them on your own. I'm not really identifying anything specific. You listen to it, it makes you feel a certain way. You take my message for what it is and you sort of digest it in your own sort of format. As far as chaos is concerned, you know, it goes back to what we have done as a civilization, the human civilization, what we have done to the world. We, like I just said, we create everything for the better, and it always usually ends up becoming a weapon that we use against ourselves. The world as we know it is chaos. Look at wars. You know, there's wars being fought right now. People die. And what is the reasoning behind it? Like, really, what does it accomplish? You know, what does bombing another country accomplish? It doesn't do good for anybody. It costs country A money that the taxpayers have to pay to bomb country B so those people can die, when the evil that is the powers that run these countries still thrives on. You know, they're hidden in some underground bunker somewhere. And the world revolves around chaos. That's just one example of many, you know, chaos based off of like human selfishness. Everywhere that I look, this selfish sort of disease that runs the world now has sort of taken over. And that is chaos. Chaos runs the world, man. This chaos exists because people cannot get enough. You know, consumption is always more, more, more. You cannot have one option. You have to have 5,000 different options. I think when it comes to fame, you know, because I'm a nobody. I mean, I am a guy who lucked out at one point in my life and got to play in some bands that had been around before me, you know, and I got to kind of help them a little bit with continuing on their sound and kind of taking their sound to a slightly different, I guess, level. Because when I joined Borknagar, they weren't as extreme and progressive as they are now in drum world. And I like to think that I sort of contributed to that a little bit. I know I did with Soulfly because they didn't have any blast beats or double bass or any of the extreme stuff before me. And I know they didn't continue on with that sound after me. So that was sort of a one shot kill, that album. But, you know, the way it works in this world is you work for what you get. And if you get lucky along the line somewhere, then you better really hold on to it and cherish it, because if you don't, it will be over in a heartbeat. And I've seen it with many people. I know a lot of musicians who sort of try to get on there and say, you know what, we're going to ride this ride and just live life that's very destructive, and it ends for them quick. I, on the other hand, decided to end it under my own terms. You know, I was sick of touring and I didn't want to do it anymore. And I kind of set personal goals for myself and said, okay, when I achieve these, that's it. We're not going to do it anymore. We're going to go and do something else. And, you know, like I said earlier, I always wanted to run trains. I just thought trains were awesome. Trains and airplanes were awesome when I was a kid, like every other boy. And now that I've done the train thing, you know, it's airplane time. But then again, you know, that goes back to what I said earlier too about life. Like, it's so short. You have to live it. You know, you cannot let anything hold you back. And being famous, I don't think is something to really work for. You know, I think creating a family and being able to provide for a family and knowing that your kids are healthy and happy, that is better than any fame. That's better than any winning lottery ticket. Knowing that you're doing something right as a human being. Being famous isn't everything. I guess that's the point I'm trying to get across.
Right, right. So one of the big questions that I've seen asked online as well of the people, because I know you said nobody's paying attention to it, but of the people that are, people want to know, are we going to see this band live? You know, with Chris being in the UK and Tony being in Fear Factory and Static X, like you said, will you guys be able to do any touring on this?
Well, here's the thing. I want to, and Rizzo wants to. Rizzo really wants to, actually, which is awesome, because who doesn't want to tour with the greatest guitar player in the world, you know? I want to, Rizzo wants to, Marco wants to, and Chris wants to. And that, to me, is amazing. Tony, I've spoken to him briefly about it. You know, Tony's always on tour, and it's like there's no hard feelings or anything. But the thing is with Tony, it's like, I cannot expect him. I feel weird almost saying, hey, Tony, I know you have Donington coming up next week with Static X or Fear Factory or whatever, but do you think you can not do that and come and play with my band that nobody's ever heard of? Like, it's just a weird conversation. It's a weird conversation for me. And I've had it with myself a few times. Like, how do I get Tony to commit to playing? And the thing is, maybe I just have to ask him and he'll say yes, because, you know, everybody flew in for the videos. He's like, sure, send me the flight info. And I sent him the flight info, and he, you know, put everybody in a hotel, and he came out and we had an awesome time making the two videos. But I would never expect Tony to think that I would be offended if he could not do it because he is so busy, because that's his livelihood, you know, that's his bread and butter, that's Static X. But maybe if there's like some downtime in between his schedule and he's able to do it, you know, he's not making an album or not touring or whatever, I'm sure he would say yes. But as far as doing it, if we had to do it next week, the four of us are ready. You know, Marco, Mark, Chris, and myself, we're 100% ready. And I would love to do it. But and then again, I have a career, you know.
Yeah.
And I'm actually like trying to change careers right now. I've been railroading now for 12 years. It's worn, it's fun out. You know, I'm not very excited doing it anymore. And I've always been an aviation geek. And I've been flying since I was 3 years old. You know, my parents work for airlines. I've been around the world numerous times on every kind of airplane. And I'm just a plane geek. And I'm going to flight school to hopefully get my ATP in a few years, which is your airline transport pilot license. So that's going to kind of be my focus now for a while, is getting my flight stuff in order. But hey, if this magically like releases and the right guy hears it and puts it on like his liquid metal radio show or whatever it's called, I know which guy
you're talking about.
Yeah. And hears it, and, you know, like 100 million people hear it and they're like, hey, this has a good hook, let's go buy it. Miraculously, I wake up to like 20 million streams. I would certainly not be against it. And the thing is, everybody in the band has done it before, and we've done it a lot, and we've all done it together, so it would turn out really, really good.
So, and I know you said that, you know, doing buy-ons and things like that would not necessarily be the route that you would want to go, and obviously this is all sort of circumstantial, but do you think that you guys would start out as some sort of an opening act, or would you try to book maybe small shows that you're headlining?
For the kind of production that I have in mind for this, because, I mean, it's big music. You know, when you listen, I don't know how far you got in the new album, but when you listen to it, it is a big production sound. The songs are written for a larger audience, and Marco and I are very, very visually driven. You know, I mean, I think the visuals are almost more important in music than the music sometimes. But then again, I could watch a band like Pink Floyd play a small theater with just the house light on. So it's really, it's sort of a juggling game, a balancing act. It depends on the band. It depends on the visuals. But for this, I would want to present it in something more than like a bar and grill in the corner, you know? So I would prefer to do a proper first show at just some, you know, smaller club, to where we could promote it properly in advance and get the place full on like a Saturday night with a handful of other really good bands from the area and say, hey, you know, this is grabbing metal by the balls, come out here and have a good time. But then again, people are like, well, I don't know any of those bands. Fuck that. I don't want to go see them. You know, fuck those bands. People don't care about this stuff. People only care about the Metallicas and Sleep Tokens and Slipknots and whatever is super huge.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that I would say is that with that, and you got to be careful about it because you don't want to seem like you're riding too much on the coattails of the past. But like, you know, sometimes, and I know that CD sales aren't even really a thing anymore. But like, you know, I know that back when that was a thing that mattered, you know, if it was somebody's new band, it's like, hey, this band featuring this guy that used to be over here. And it was like a way to get attention and eyes and ears on the thing.
Yeah, but you said it, the first thing you said there, that's exactly where I'm at too. There's, again, you're walking a real tight line when it comes to riding coattails and name dropping and stuff, because I mean, I'm guilty of having done it before. You know, I've used X Borknagar and X Soulfly and all this stuff, and that's only because that's what the metal media does. You know, every headline you look at, it always says this band featuring X members of blah, 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 and current members of blah, blah, blah. That's just their format.
Right.
Yes, I guess it is sort of like a bait. You know, you're sort of like chumming the waters a bit more than, hey, this band you've never heard of. that will generate more clicks if it says X band, this and that. But then again, it's like, I think people almost expect a certain sound out of you if you say X Soulfly. You know, yeah. This doesn't sound anything. I mean, there's bits and pieces that do have a Soulfly-esque kind of quality, but guess what? That's not me trying to copy Soulfly. That's not because Rizzo's in the band and said, oh, we have to have nothing like that whatsoever. It's because Soulfly, at one time in my life, and Sepultura even more, were very influential to the musician that I ended up becoming, you know? And it's the same with Metallica. Like, there are riffs on this album and big progressive parts that I can say, hey, I was thinking like the Master of Puppets album when I came up with this riff, because that's what the riff feels like to me. It runs along like a Master of Puppets song would, you know? Or there's songs like that have an Opeth influence. So everything, like I said, everything is oversaturated. Everything's been done. And at this point, it's almost just like you're trying to pick little ingredients out of the big pot of fucking stew that's been sitting there for 40 years now. And you're trying to like rinse them off and put them on a white plate and see, okay, what is this? This is cayenne pepper, or this is a piece of celery. Okay, let's see how I can go and take this ingredient, but transform it into my own dish. You know, it's a weird world, man.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. Now, going back to a hypothetical live show for the Monarch, I know that sometimes when band lineups change, bands will only play songs from like whatever the band's current era is. Will the live shows contain songs from both albums?
I would like it to. The thing is, the first album has one song that really wasn't totally written by me or us at the time, and it was a song called Last Dose. We actually did a video for it, and it was written by the main melody and kind of like the role of the song, you know, the spread of the song was written by the singer and a friend of his, which, you know, they got credit for and all that good stuff. But it's just kind of a song that at the time when we were making the album, it felt like, man, this is real ballady and it's awesome and it's so simple. Let's go and create a song out of this little thing that Jarrett sent me. And we ended up creating a song that was like way too long, like 7 fucking minutes long.
Yeah.
You know, but then again, I'm like, okay, this needs a guitar solo. It needs like a really epic guitar solo in the like end towards the middle. And then this big, huge ending. So it did kind of become my song, you know, because I did orchestrate the song to what it became. But that song now, when I can't even listen to it, because we tried the ballad thing, it didn't work. People like it, but it didn't catch on. And people like who are anybody, you know, with power in the music industry, they're like, yeah, we don't want to hear a 7-minute long ballad from a band that plays like has double bass in the next song. You know, that's Metallica did that. They profited off of that, but you know, no point in doing that anymore. Metallica already did it the best. So that song probably wouldn't be in my live set, but there are definitely a handful of songs on the first album that I'd love to have, because, you know, they were written 25 years ago now.
And then given the resume of all of the members that are currently in the band, is there any consideration to any cover songs that might get thrown in, either from members, other projects, or just something that you guys didn't have anything to do with but really like to play?
See, we're not like something that started in a garage or a basement, you know, and all those bands that I look up to, you know, the camaraderie brotherhood bands started playing covers, you know, especially Metallica. They're the best band in the world as far as I'm concerned when it comes to covers. They do a cover better than the original person did the song. So it's not like this started out doing covers and we got really good at them and wrote our own shit, you know, like Metallica and Pantera and whatnot. I would love to do, like, I do have a dream list of covers I would love to do. And I mean, it goes down the list from, you know, there's a Metallica song on there. There's classical Gas on there. There's Fleetwood Mac. There's Pink Floyd. Like, I would love to make a cover album if I had $100,000 to just go and sit in a studio.
Right.
But realistically, for a live thing, I don't think it would be appropriate to do songs from our other bands or just, you know, our favorites. I think doing this as its own thing would be the best bet.
Fair enough. That makes sense. Everybody's got a different outlook on it. So that's why I asked the one thing that comes to mind for me. And I don't know if it's a band that you've heard of, because they're like local to this area and the scene, was a band called The Silencer. And a couple of their members had previously been in the band Julius Caesar. So when they did their first show, they were like, let's throw a Julius Caesar song into the set. Why not?
I like that name, The Silencer.
Yeah, they're great. They're main dude, Charlie, he's been on the show like four times, I think. So from the new album, you guys have released two music videos so far. I know that Chris had mentioned in a YouTube clip that you had posted that he flew out, you guys recorded them in the same day. They've both been released. Will there be any other videos released for songs on this album?
No. Unfortunately, the whole promotional process in the beginning for this campaign, quote unquote, it kind of tumbled, because we released the first single, first video. It was awesome. The response was awesome. And then somebody came up with the idea to release the second single, When Death Finds You, on Halloween. And that was only like 2 weeks after the first one. And I'm like, man, I think this is really quick. But at that time, we were pushing the release to come out in November for the album. So it made more sense. So we released the singles back to back, basically, you know, within a couple weeks. And then, because of a credit dispute, a stupid little credit dispute, we had to shut down the plans for the release. And it just kept getting pushed back. And I'm not a fan of lawyers or legal processes or any of that stuff, but man, I never was one in the beginning. Like, I'm not, you know, someone that's ever had to hire a lawyer other than to deal with my dad's estate. I never want to go through that again, because lawyers just drag shit out so long. And it's like, I'm emailing this girl every day. Hey, look, I got to get this album released. They're like, okay. And I wouldn't hear anything for like 3 weeks, you know? And it's like, it's all because of a credit issue. Like, come on, I can just talk to this person and resolve it on the phone. Nope, that person doesn't want to talk to you. They want to do it through your lawyer. Okay, so the whole release plan got screwed up because of a stupid little error that I made, and it's fixed, but man, did I pay for it in the end, you know? Because here we are, it's coming out May 3rd.
Yeah.
You know, six months late.
Right. And that was going to be another thing that I asked, is I don't want to look past the release of the album, because I'm very excited for it. But being that there was this 6 month delay, have you been working on anything else in the interim?
As far as new material?
Yeah, as far as new material for a potential third album or EP or, you know, something else Monarch related or not. But like, it's been six months. Have you been working on anything else in between?
So actually, the songs that are on this album now, all of the songs from when the former guitar player was in the band that I put together with him, those are all on this album, because it was good. I wasn't gonna shift sound after someone left, you know. It's like, granted, this guy only contributed a little teeny bit, but the sound was so good I couldn't walk away from it, you know.
Yeah,
it's just like, here's a good example. Devin Townsend. He is a solo artist who brings in different musicians to work with. And every single album of his sounds a lot a bit different. Some of them really, really make sense to me. And some of them I'm like, what is this guy doing? Like, the sound's just, and they're all brilliant, but the sound just changes drastically. I didn't want to change the sound because someone left, you know, and I was already like on this highway to getting these songs to where they are now. So I figured, you know what, I'm going to write a couple more songs on my own at home, finish this album. And I actually ended up writing like six more songs, but we already had five songs that were from like 2021. So you can only add so much, you know? So I added a handful of songs and a little bits and pieces of like palate cleansers with piano pieces here and there. And I figured, this is it, man. This album's over an hour long already. Leave it there. The rest can go on the next album. So yeah, there's actually about 9 songs ready for the next album, if it even happens.
All right. And you kind of touched on it a bit, but anytime that I do one of these shows, one thing that I always ask whoever it is how do you feel about the current state of like where the music industry is? And what I sort of mean with this specifically is again, I had mentioned before about like, you know, a time when CD sales mattered, and that's not now. You know, everything is streaming, or, you know, I think that because streaming is such a big thing, there's not as much illegal downloading, but that is certainly still a thing, you know. And I always hear from people like, well, you don't have to buy the music. Like, bands make all their money at shows. They don't make their money off music. And it's like, well, but they don't make their money off music because you don't fucking buy it.
Yeah.
And so there's this weird thing, you know, and I still buy music. You know, that's why I had mentioned to you before we started, when I was still doing the prep, you know, that I'd looked up the CD on Amazon and whatnot, you know, because I still buy CDs. I've got a whole shelf of physical media downstairs, you know, that I don't know what the hell my kids are going to do with when I die. But like, you know, I'm still a CD guy. And yeah, I'll rip it to the computer, I'll put it on my cell phone, whatever. But like the fact that it seems that music has become devalued in the current landscape. Like, how do you feel about that as an artist?
Well, you know, when I started driving, a weekly event for me was going Monday night to Tower Records. And that's when they would stay open a little bit later. They would stay open until about 12:15, because midnight on Tuesday every week was New Music Day.
Right.
Now it's Fridays, but it used to be Tuesday, you know, 25 years ago. And I would go to Tower Records, and there were so many CDs of bands that I had never even heard of that I bought based off of the cover art alone. You know, I'd find something that looked killer, and I'm like, I've never heard of this band. I need to buy this. And 9 times out of 10, it was a good purchase. You know, so that was taken away from me and all of us. And you know, that was a ritual. I loved doing that. Now I can't do that. And it almost seems like that whole process, you know, like when you would get a new CD and you'd open it up and you'd like fight with the cellophane and then get it off and try to not crack the jewel case while you're opening it. And then you'd look at the booklet and the art and read all the credits and shit. That was a process. That doesn't exist anymore, you know? The whole thing with heavy metal is almost like they've taken the lazy way out. I think Metallica was right and Lars was right to fight Napster, because right around when all of that LimeWire and the Pirate Bay and Napster and all that stuff started popping up is when you started to see places like Tower and Sam Goody and even Suncoast Video all start to just disappear. And that's because people started taking it without paying for it. How can the places stay around if nobody's going to pay for this stuff? They can get it for free on the fucking Pirate Bay, you know? And it really, it's sad, but that's where it went. Kids today, they'll never know like what it was like browsing a CD store. Hell, you can't even find bookstores anymore. You know, right. I used to love walking around Borders and Barnes and Noble, you know, and just looking at books. And so pop music, rap music, if you can call that shit music, you know, all this stuff that's really out of the box and simple and over synthesized and processed and has absolutely no like stamina to the lyrics. Like if you ever actually listen to the lyrics of this really popular stuff, it's garbage, man. Like how does this stuff grab anybody? You know, when you read the lyrics to Fade to Black or Comfortably Numb or Wish You Were Here or the Fleetwood Mac lyrics from years ago, you know, like I would have loved being at Fleetwood Mac 40-50 years ago, because sex, drugs and rock and roll, like that band actually lived it, you know. I mean, now this stuff where it's just like it's talking about all this degrading sexual stuff, and it's just music is nothing. It's noise that kids go and I guess they get high to. You know, and it's just, it's sad, dude. I don't even know, man. And metal, I admit, I don't really pay attention to current metal. You know, there's certain bands like that Lorna Shore band. I have given a good amount of time to trying to understand them. And the drummer is phenomenal. The drummer is very talented, and I could never play drums like that. Like years ago, I used to be able to, but I used to at least have speed then. But I just can't get into this music. You know, it's just all over the place. And it's like, okay. I mean, granted, it's heavy music and it's doing well and kids are into it, but you got to have that room to breathe. And I don't hear any bands that are just coming out of the woodwork and grabbing me like the bands used to, you know? So you ask the state of music these days, man, I think it's in a bad place. And now look at it. I mean, AI has taken over. People are using AI to go and write lyrics and write songs, and you can have it like be your whole band. I saw a video yesterday on Facebook of a drummer who was proudly talking about how he wrote this entire song with AI, and he was playing drums along to it. And I'll give it to him, like, at least he was playing drums, but the whole song was written by AI. Like, where is the creativity? Where is the heart and soul in this? You know, it doesn't exist. People don't care about physical. They listen to Spotify, which Spotify to me is bullshit, because I am an album listener, you know, and that's how this new Monarch album is designed to be a beginning to end listen. You know, it's not like, oh, I'm going to listen to track 11 and then track 2. You listen from the beginning to the end, and you have to experience the whole thing, preferably on a Bose system, because it's designed around my Bose system in my truck. You know, that's where I okayed all the mixes. And music is supposed to be an emotional experience. The Spotify only offers you like random songs. At least that's how I can't figure out how to listen to an entire album straight through on Spotify. And then a fucking ad for like a hairdryer or Target or some shit will pop up in the middle, you know?
Yeah. So that, I think that that's the model for if you don't pay for it, if you pay them, which it's baffling to me that not that people are paying for it, but the people are paying for it and they still pay the artist shit. But if you're paying for it, then you can listen to whatever you want, whenever you want, in whatever order. But if you don't have a paid subscription, then if you pick a specific song, you can only listen to a 30-second clip of it. You know, you can only listen to stuff on shuffle, and you get a commercial every like 2 songs.
Yeah. So it's not even like, at least the radio, you know, everybody criticizes radio. Because you put on like in any city, you know, Cleveland, Philadelphia, Chicago, you put on the classic rock station, you are guaranteed to hear Led Zeppelin, AC/DC, Van Halen, and Enter Sandman all in the same every hour. You know, it's right. Always going to be the same shit. But hey, I mean, at least it's radio. You know, it's still semi old school. And that's how I used to learn of a lot of bands through radio back in the 90s.
Right.
But now it's, you know, I do use Apple Music, because Apple to me is very close to that same experience, minus having the physical, but it's that same experience of like walking up to the CD shelf and picking out which album I want to listen to. Oh, okay. I have Slayer and I have all 48 of their albums, or I have AC/DC, or I have, you know, whoever in there. I mean, I have thousands of bands in my Apple Music, and I have their entire discographies, and I can listen to whatever I want. And usually it's like really good audio quality, you know, lossless or whatnot. But my truck, I'm looking at my truck right now, and it's just 2 screens. There's a screen in front of me and a screen to the right for like the central whatever control center. There's no CD player, exchanger, or whatever head unit in here. Just like, dude, everything has become so simplified and stupefied, and all the essence and the nostalgia is gone. It sucks.
Well, it's crazy, too, and I still don't understand it. I've asked some artists I've had on the show, and I still don't get it. It's weird is that on one end, there's this push to streaming, but then vinyl is becoming a thing again.
I noticed that. Yeah, vinyl.
Like you go into Target and they've slimmed down their physical media area.
Yeah.
And then 75% of it is vinyl, with like a couple of new CDs. Like, I think I don't follow pop music, but I've heard that like Taylor Swift has a new album out, so I'm sure they have that there on CD. But like, but most of what they have at Target and at Walmart is in the realm of physical music media is vinyl records instead of CDs.
And you know, I have a buddy who loves vinyl. He collects vinyl like crazy. Huge Black Sabbath and Ozzy fan. And I've kind of gotten it out of him. You know, he's really into going to like the resale shops and thrift shops and all that, and going through like to try to find the hidden sort of gems, you know, the diamonds in the rough that are like an original pressing of Diary of a Madman or whatever.
Yeah.
But he will also go and buy like the Target or Walmart release of, I don't know, Injustice for All, just to have it, just to say that he has it. I guess, who knows, maybe in 10, 15 years, CDs will make a huge comeback like vinyl. I think it's a little bit more of a personal kind of thing though, because with vinyl, you can't just drive around and listen to vinyl. You have to be at home. You have to have a really nice set of speakers, a good quality record player, you know, and I guess like the types of record players now, belt driven versus not driven, are like a big deal for some of these guys. Like, don't get this one because it's driven by a belt, and like 99.9% are driven by a belt. Nope, it can only be listened to on the standard that has the motor directly under the turntable top. But hey, I mean, I gotta give it to them, because vinyl sounds amazing, and you are taking the time to sit and really enjoy and look at that double gatefold, you know, and look at the art and read the lyrics and whatnot. I mean, it's the experience that we had that we took for granted during the CD days, you know?
Yeah, what was funny was the last time, you know, I mentioned I had Doc Coyle on a couple of times. The last time I had him on, I asked him about it. He's like, the only thing I can, he's like, it's bigger. I was like, what do you mean? He's like, it's just physically bigger. Like, you can look at the art more. Like, it's a bigger thing to hold in your hand. And so for people that want to hold the thing, it's a bigger thing to hold. I was like, I guess that makes sense.
Yeah, I mean, the Pink Floyd albums were all of those, the Storm Thorgerson artwork. That's something that you have to look at. At something, I think, more than a phone, because it's just his artwork was so beautiful. And like I said earlier, artwork is so important. The visuals are so important for the music, because it has to relate. If you have art that doesn't make sense to the sound, it's like, what's going on here? And Doc was right, man. I mean, it's bigger and you get to look at it closer and really observe all the fine details, like the Seagrave art from all the death metal bands back in the day. If you really look at all that Dan Seagrave stuff, because he used to draw everything out, and these are real works of art where there's so much, like the Slayer covers even, you know, you look at the stuff and really pick out the fine details. There's so much more going on than just what the eye catches at a glance, you know?
For me, it's always been, you know, like, I'm not shitting on anybody. I don't get it. You know, I did buy a record from one band that's one of my favorites, just because it was like, they were like, hey, we just released this. I was like, all right, well, I'll buy it to support this band that I'm friends with. But I didn't even have any way to play it. Or like when I, a few albums ago, because again, I'm so much of like a physical media person that whenever it comes to, you know, if there's like a deluxe edition of the album or whatever, I'll buy it. And so there was, you know, two or three Disturbed albums ago. You know, it was like the deluxe edition, but like there wasn't a way to buy it by itself. Like you had to, it was the CD and the vinyl. It was like, all right, I guess I've got a Disturbed vinyl now. Like, I don't know what I'm going to do with it, except maybe hang it on the wall, but I've got it.
Yeah. I mean, I have some vinyls, you know, I have vinyl copies of the Borknagar album. Well, one of them that I did, the other one, they never gave me one because I had left the band by then. And I have a copy of the Soulfly album too. I mean, it's just a cool keepsake, you know, collectors like that stuff. And it's good. You know, one day down the road, some kid who is hopefully trained properly by their dad, who's like an obsessive Beatles fan or Metallica fan or whatever, is going to inherit all this stuff and hopefully take care of it, you know, to show his kids and be like, hey, these were my dad's, or these were your grandfather's back in the day, and this is how they used to do it. But look, this is what music used to be. And kids will be like, really? Hey, I never existed back in 1977. You know, like, because dude, it's taken over, man. Everybody, like, album covers and music's being written in AI. I'm sure everybody's writing lyrics in AI now. It's sad, dude. You know, I had to sit here for the lyric process at the end of last year. I was cranking away with the lyrics because I really procrastinated trying to get them done. And I'm sitting there with like dictionaries open on one computer, the word processor open on another computer, a thesaurus page. I'm looking up like what rhymes with this and what is dark and rhymes with this word and what's another word for forager. And dude, I mean, it's writing lyrics sucks, but I kind of enjoy it because it really opens you up to a whole different world of creativity. You know, I never wanted to write lyrics, but the only reason I started is because I didn't have anybody to write them. Writing lyrics is strange though, man. And I'm sure there's bands out there having AI do all their lyric writing now. Hey, AI, write me a song about death and blood and darkness, you know?
Yeah, I'm sure that's coming, but or is already here. But like, even though it sounds like it's definitely going to be a more arduous process, I definitely, you know, appreciate it being done like by a real person.
Yeah.
So the only other thing that I have left to ask you, and we, again, it's something we kind of touched on a little bit already. You know, you'd mentioned that you have, you know, the day that this releases is going to be the day that the album comes out. You've already got stuff written for the next album and you hope to do some shows. You know, the last question is always just what's next?
Well, I don't know. I guess the older I get, I'm slowing and starting to think before acting. It only took 40 years, but I mean, through all of the emotional, you know, the loss and stuff, especially creating the album was really tough. And it became so therapeutic that I had to get it done. But by the end of it, I was like, I can't see doing this again for a while. And then a few months go by and I'm focusing on trying to get the release done. And I start hearing sounds in my head. I start, you know, riffs. I'm not insane, but I start hearing riffs and I'm like, man, this kind of reminds me of a song that's on this last album. But it's different. And I wish I had made this song sound like this. Well, you know what? Let's hum it into my phone just for the hell of it. 45 minutes later, it's taken a turn and it has a breakdown and a chorus and a pre-chorus and a bridge. And I'm like, holy shit, I have a new song written in 45 minutes that I've been sitting here humming for, you know, whatever. And here's one song down. Okay, cool. And you start to kind of notice that, like, after two or three of them that they've evolved, like the sound has evolved a little bit. And it's just a bunch of, you know, metaphorical sounding almost, because it's literally going from hums in my head to humming it in my phone. But I do hear a direction. And I think the next direction would be a little bit more extreme and a little bit darker, almost black metal-esque, if I was to make another album. And would it be great to play shows? Absolutely. I want to play shows. I want to do tours with this. I had a great time touring the world, and I would certainly have a great time touring the world with like my own guys in my own band, you know, playing stuff that we created and recorded together. Absolutely. If it happens, great. If it doesn't, I'm not like putting all my balls into one bucket. You know, life is short and you have to kind of take it for what it is and not live in the past, not dwell in the past. But the most important life lesson, I think, is to be individual and to learn who you are and figure out what you're good at and what you're not good at and focus on what you are good at. And I don't know if I'm a good musician or not, but I know that we have sort of a sound that is very in our own, you know. Granted, it sounds like other bands here and there, but that's because those other bands probably influenced me at one time. And the only real thing that I worry about every day is my family and making sure that the bills are paid. So we're going to see what happens with the music and with the band stuff. And I'm going to keep on pushing on, trying to get my flight hours and all my schooling done for flight school to see where that takes me. And just hope to wake up every day because life ends, man. Life ends for everyone.
Yeah, no, I get that. It was funny. My wife gets mad at me because, you know, like I said, you and I are the same age. If your birth date is accurate on Wikipedia, you're only a couple months older than I am. And I didn't think I'd make it to 40. And so once I turned 40, I was like, now what? She's like, I was like, I was supposed to be dead by now. She's like, don't say that.
Yeah, I take vitamins every day religiously. I take vitamins. In the past 16 months, because I gained a lot of weight after my back surgery. I had back surgery in 2016. I gained over 100 pounds. In the past 16 months, I've lost 120 pounds. Wow. And I don't drink. I don't take drugs or anything like that, but I take vitamins every day. I eat really healthy now. It's like, what's after 40? Dude, I'm trying to totally have like another career after 40. So I think there's a lot after 40. It's just all about being careful and not overdoing it, you know, because as you've seen, you know, you hurt your back and it was probably really easy to hurt your back. And
it was a car accident.
Well, there you go. You didn't even have to do anything. You know, I mean, not to be morbid, but it's real easy to fuck your back up, dude. I mean, it's creepy how fragile we are as human beings. You know, I'm going to go in a little bit here and go to work and run a train at 70 miles an hour. And there are really unfortunate events that happen where people just say, you know what, I've had enough. And they jump out in front of trains all the time. And it's a really messed up experience for me because I have to see it, and obviously for them because they're brutally deciding to end their life probably over something that's not so bad if they would have just thought it out. And every day I think, you know, when my back hurts, especially in the mornings, because that's when my painful time of day is, I think, man, I really wish I had not gone down that one cobblestone street in Holland on my bicycle, because I'd probably be in a lot better shape, you know, back physical wise than I am now. But life is strange, dude. It throws you curveballs every day. It just depends if you can catch them or not, you know?
Yeah. So with my back, I was on the way to meet a friend. He lived, I was going to college at William Patterson. He lived down in like Edison. He wanted me to meet him down in Edison, and then he was going to drive the rest of the way to Philly so we could go see Dragon Force and Killswitch Engage.
Oh, nice.
And I had said to him, I said, hey, I want to stop and get cash out before the show, and I don't want to get hit with any stupid ATM fees. You know, the bank that I was going to at the time, Valley National Bank. I said, is there a Valley Bank down by you? He's like, I'm not sure, man. He's like, if there's one on your way, like, just stop just to get it out of the way. Like, don't count on there being one down here. I was like, all right, fair enough. Because William Patterson's in Wayne. Valley's based out of Wayne. So there's like five of them just in that town.
Yeah.
So I was like, so I'm just like on Hamburg Turnpike in Wayne, just waiting to turn into Valley Bank, just stopped waiting for to be able to turn. And this girl driving her daddy's Benz, not paying attention to what she's doing, just plows into the back end of my car at 50 miles an hour.
Oh my God.
And now my back is fucked up for the rest of my life.
See, you didn't do a damn thing and that happened. Life is strange, dude. I'm telling you, it can be over in the blink of an eye. And I think this society has absolutely no understanding to that. I mean, you know, obviously I'm not going to get rolling on how messed up the world is, but people are 100% focused on themselves, and that's it. Themselves and their phones. Their phones are always in their hands. They drive on their phone. They walk across in front of trains on their phone. And it's just like, stop and pay attention to the world for a minute, and you might learn something, and you might see how beautiful it is when you're not paying attention to something else that doesn't even concern you. She was probably on the phone when she hit you too, huh?
Probably, because I said, oh, do you have, you know, first thing was like, oh, we got to call the cops. Do you have a cell phone? Oh, I don't know where it is.
Yeah, flew out of my hand. I'm sorry, dude. I feel your pain, literally. You know, I'm always dealing with it on my own. It sucks, but shit happens, I guess.
Yeah, like I said, I'm due for another surgery. They told me 2 years ago, they're like, you need another surgery, or 3 years ago at this point. They're like, you need another surgery. I was like, I had surgery like 10 years ago. They're like, yeah, that's about the going rate for a surgery before you need another one. When I went to the doctor at the time, I weighed like 280 pounds. They're like, we really want you to drop like 50 pounds before we'll do the surgery. I was like, how the fuck am I supposed to do that if it hurts to exist? Like, I can't exercise, like eat better. I was like, all right, I guess I can try that. But like, that has not bore much fruit. And so I've just been kind of dealing with it. They've got me on some medications for like a muscle relaxer and a anti-inflammatory that I've got to make sure that I take, because I had a period of time last year where like I wasn't feeling well. Mm-hmm. I just got lazy with taking my meds and didn't take my meds for like a week. And I realized like, hey, I didn't take my meds for a week and I don't feel terrible. And then like later that day, my back spasmed and I couldn't move. If I'm not medicated, just existing hurts. And even medicated, like the floor doesn't exist to me. If I drop something, I've got to ask like somebody else to pick it up because I can't get down there.
Yeah. No, I trust me. Cyclobenzaprine and Norcos were like, because I see a pain doctor. and trying to revolve my life around that and, you know, just exist and be able to be physical. This is impossible. And just in the past couple months, I finally weaned off of everything, and it sucks, you know, and I'm in pain right now. But, you know, in order to fly airplanes, you can't be taking, you can't really take any medication. It sucks, but I feel for you, man. Whatever you do, just, you know, make sure that as far as fusions are concerned, that you really think about it, because I've known people who've had fusions that it hasn't worked for. And they want me to have a fusion. I refuse to. There's just no way I'm not going to let myself be completely immobile. Not happening.
Yeah, I asked them about that. They're like, oh, you'll lose a little bit of mobility, but like ultimately it'll be better. Like the only other thing you got to worry about is that once that's fused, it's going to put more strain on the next disc up, and there's a chance of herniating that then. I was like, oh, cool.
Yeah, yeah, it supposedly spreads.
But all right, man. Well, I know that you got to get going to work soon, and we've been going for like 2 hours now. But I want to thank you for your time. And like I said, I can't wait to, I don't have to wait. You sent me the album, so I can't wait to finish listening to it. But I can't wait for the release and to see how people react to it. And hopefully
it
helps to to get the word out.
Yeah. Let me know how you like it when you're done. Make sure you listen to it all the way through, because when you think it's over, it's actually not over. It kind of, there's a hidden track 6 minutes later on the last track. All right. Sounds good, dude.
All right. Cool. Thanks a lot, Dave.
Yep. Take it easy.
from the new album A Moment to Lose Your Breath. That was The Monarch with Man-Made Chaos. I want to thank Dave for being on the show. If you want to follow The Monarch on social media, you can follow them on Facebook at Official Monarch Band and on Instagram at The Monarch Band Official. And you can get that new album. It's out today anywhere that you stream or purchase music. You know what I'm going to say later, buy music, or it's buy music, but it is also available to stream if you choose to do so. You can also follow all of the other band members on social media. They're different usual places. Just look up, you know, Tony Campos, Chris Clancy, Marco Martel, Mark Rizzo, Dave Kincaid, and you can find them wherever you look. As for J Bunny's Music Hub, obviously you can follow J Bunny's Music Hub on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram. We have that Patreon that we're not really doing anything with. We have a TikTok that we're not really doing anything with. So follow me those places. Follow Industry Embers on Facebook and Twitter if you believe in buying music like I do. And use the hashtag buymusic, B-U-Y, or it's buymusic, B-Y-E, to tweet or post your purchases. And being that Chris Clancy is in this band and he was one of the people that helped to found the Industry Embers, I'm sure that he would love to see a bunch of purchases of the Monarch album A Moment to Lose Your Breath with that hashtag on social media, so fucking do it. As for what is next for the show, there have been talks of having other members of the Monarch on the show. As you all know, because I've mentioned it in the most recent few episodes, I've been working with Mark Rizzo and helping to book shows for him as a solo act and for his cover band Acoustic Vendetta around New Jersey, northern New Jersey mostly, and the surrounding areas. We had a show with Acoustic Vendetta at the beginning of April in Middletown, New York. So, you know, this sort of general area, if you're in this area. So I can sort of talk to Mark whenever, but, you know, get him back on the show. Would love to talk to Chris Clancy about Mutiny Within and the Monarch and everything that he's done in between. Would love to talk to Tony Campos, Static X, Fear Factory. And Marco was the other member of the band I was not familiar with, but him and Dave are friends, and he seems like he'd be a great guy to talk to as well. So, like I said, hoping we can get all these guys on here. There are some other... I'm still trying to make up some podcasts that got canceled on me back in, like, March. Not making any progress there as of yet. I've got some other people reaching out to me, some past guests that want to be back on. Just got to find out the scheduling and some other bands that I... love. There's some members I want to get on here. So a lot still going on. I'm going to try to have more output in 2024 than we did in 2023, and we're already well on our way. So keep an eye out. Now, I'm going to leave you guys today with another new song from the new Monarch album, A Moment to Lose Your Breath. This song is called Soul Collector. Until next time, guys.